Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. If you were listening yesterday, you know that my voice was gone because of laryngitis, which I got over the weekend. And you can tell probably that it's still not altogether normal. However, I think I have enough volume to make it through the show, and I hope that you'll be able to call with your questions as normally, and we can have the same kind of conversation as we normally would. And don't feel sorry for me. I don't have a sore throat or there's no pain. It's just there's not much volume, and my voice squeaks and cracks a little bit once in a while when I try to project it. However, that's going to get better every day, I assume. And so we'll just keep plugging through the week, and within a day or two, hopefully you won't even notice the difference. If you'd like to be on the program, by the way, my name's Steve Gregg, and you can call me if you have questions about the Bible or about Christianity or about your own spiritual walk, and we can talk about that. If you have a difference of opinion from something you've heard me say here on the program before, you're more than welcome to call and balance comment and bring another viewpoint. Let me give you the phone number. The number is 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And this is the first of the month, first day of the month, which means that we paid our radio bills today. I sent checks. And, I received an email yesterday from a listener in California who wanted me to pass along this information. He's a listener in California, but he's interested in seeing this program succeed in the Seattle area. Now, I don't know that he has any connections to Seattle particularly. It's just that that's the newest market we've expanded into. We've been in Seattle for 3 months now. And it does take a while, you know, for a new area to generate enough financial support to pay the bills there. And we have been just trusting God in one way or another. The money has come in, but not mostly from Seattle area listeners. Now, we have received some generous gifts from Seattle listeners. And I just want to say this because he wrote to me, and he wants to make an offer. You may remember that during the first 3 months we were on, this is the same fellow who offered to match gifts that were either from Seattle or designated for the Seattle audience, for the Seattle station, KCIS. For the first 3 months we were there, he was willing to match gifts up to $1,000 so that the first $1,000 that were given toward the Seattle expenses were matched by another $1,000 from this donor, although he's in California. Well, he's up to that for the next 3 months, and he wants. I'll just read what he said. He said he wants to encourage Seattle listeners to support the program by telling their friends about it and by giving. So he has agreed to match all gifts from the Seattle area or in support of the Seattle station in each of the months of June, July, and August, up to $2,000 per month. So he's doubling his offer. If we get $2,000 donated, designated for the Seattle station, then he will match that. And by the way, with his matching gift, and that will actually cover the cost of that month. So he'll do that for the next month. He wants Seattle listeners to tell their friends about the program, and if they give the first total of $2,000 that comes each month, he will match, and therefore your gift will be worth double that. He says he's hoping by September that the Seattle audience will be self-supporting. He wanted me to mention that when we first went on the air in Las Vegas, he made a similar matching offer of $1,000 a month, and that helped us, of course, to be able to remain in the early days that we were on our Las Vegas station. You may notice that we get probably more calls from Las Vegas than anywhere else these days, and the Las Vegas audience has stepped up, and they do support the costs of being there. So he's hoping something like that will happen in Seattle. Also, we do get calls from Seattle. We get some assistance from people in Seattle, but the costs are much greater than the amount we've been getting in. So I give you that information because my friend who emailed me about this told me to do so. Okay, let's talk to Sandy from San Jose, California. Hi, Sandy. Hey, Sandy, you were the topic of one of our calls yesterday.
Yesterday or the day before?
Oh, I thought it was yesterday. Maybe it was the day before.
I remember hearing something about it. What was the topic?
Oh, it was just a caller. It was just a caller who said that he when he first started listening to the program, he heard you calling so frequently, he thought a co-host or something.
Yeah, I heard that a couple of days ago, too. I was kind of impressed by it. Yeah. I made a good time there. Hey, I had a question for you. I have a couple, actually. But one of the points to your listeners out there, one of the things I really respect about you, Steve, and I mean this sincerely, is you don't charge for anything. I mean, the stuff that I pulled off your website alone, you know, to go to other ministries to get this stuff, you'd pay, you know, some reasonable cash for it. So, like right now, I'm going through the Isaiah for the second time, this time chronological order, and because we're doing it in BSS, so I hope to be all ready for those guys next year. So, anyway, just a small little bit there. Had a question regarding, and I would take these off the air because, number one, I got to get back to work. Number two, okay, as much as I love to hear myself talk, I'd rather have you talk. So my two questions are 2 Thessalonians 2, the man of lawlessness and the restrainer. Went through Gary DeMar's book. He at least conjectures, he doesn't say for sure, that those guys would be sort of the Jewish ruling leaders, perhaps Phinehas or John of Grishala. Have you heard those names before?
Yes, I have. Actually, I've read what Gary DeMar says about that.
Okay. And then, my question is, number one, you know, do you agree with that? If not, who do you think? And then the straining force he believes was Rome. So that's my first question. And then if you have time, the second question is totally unrelated, which is when the word the angel of the Lord is spoken in, the Old Testament, sometimes they hear it referred to as Christ, sometimes just a super powerful angel. I just, every time I read that verse, I really don't know what they're talking about. So those are my two questions. I'll take them off the air unless you have any questions for me to clarify.
No, I think I understand your questions.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Steve. I appreciate it.
Okay, Sandy. Thanks.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye now. Well, let's take the second one first because it takes less to answer. The Old Testament often refers to a character or a participant in the stories who is called the angel of the Lord. Now, that's not an angel of the Lord. It's the angel of the Lord. And therefore, the definite article suggests a particular angel or messenger of the Lord. Remember, the word angel just means messenger. So there's the messenger of the Lord that comes and talks at various times to people like Moses or to Abraham or to, lots of different people, Manoah and others. It's like the angel of the Lord appears frequently in the Old Testament. Now, whenever the angel of the Lord speaks, he speaks as if he is God. And that is, he speaks in the first person as if it's God speaking. A little bit like what happens when a prophet prophesies. They speak as if they are God speaking. This has led many to believe that the angel of the Lord is a reference to an appearance of God himself in the form of a messenger, what is sometimes called a theophany, an appearance of God. And some would say that it's even an appearance of Christ before his incarnation. We know that from the scripture that Christ existed in a divine form, in the form of God, it says in Philippians 2, before he came to earth. And many people believe that these theophanies, where God appeared in the Old Testament in a human-like form, that this was really Christ appearing before his own incarnation on earth. Now, I don't know that that could be proven to be true or false. It does seem, though, that the angel of the Lord, the way he speaks as if he is God, and therefore, unless somebody objected to the idea of there being theophanies or appearances of God in a human-like form in the Old Testament, then it would seem that to make the angel of the Lord out to be a theophany would be sensible. That is a common view, perhaps the most common view, among evangelical scholars, I think. And therefore, it's a view that seems to have a fair bit in its favor. The alternative would be it's just an angel who speaks as if he is God, just like a prophet speaks as if he's God. He speaks the word of the Lord. But I have no problem with the possibility that the angel of the Lord is a theophany. A theophany is an appearance of God in the Old Testament in a visible form. Now, as far as your other question about the man of lawlessness and what restrains him in 2 Thessalonians 2, there Paul says that there is a man of lawlessness that is going to arise and set himself in the temple of God, proclaiming that he is God, and that he will be destroyed by the brightness of Christ's coming. But he says that that man of sin has not yet arisen, Paul says, because there was something that was restraining him from arising. And Paul does not say what it was that was restraining him from arising. But Paul says that that which is restraining the rise of the man of lawlessness will be removed. And when that that restraint is removed, then the man of lawlessness will rise. Now, the most popular view of that in modern American evangelicalism is that this is talking about a future Antichrist, and that he will rise in the end times just before Jesus comes back. And they often will say that the thing that is restraining him now from rising is the presence of the Holy Spirit in the world, in the church. Or sometimes they would just say the presence of the church in the world is restraining the rise of the man of sin. That is a popular dispensational view, and it's what probably most people have heard if they've heard anything about this. You were asking about Gary DeMar's view. Now, Gary DeMar is a preterist. He believes that that this prophecy and many others have been fulfilled in the destruction of Jerusalem in A.D. 70. And therefore, he looks for the man of lawlessness to be somebody who was prominent in the Jewish war. And the restrainer of that man of lawlessness is something also that was around at that time. His view, I believe, is that the restraint was the Roman presence in the form of the procurators, and that that kind of broke down during the Jewish war, and there were some very evil leaders who might be identified as the man of lawlessness, one of whom was John Gershala, who, according to Josephus, was a very blasphemous and evil leader of a very wicked faction in Jerusalem during the siege of Jerusalem. John Gershala actually went into the temple of God and profaned it. And that is probably why Gary DeMar thinks that he'd make a good candidate. Now, those are two very different views, of course. Gary DeMar's view is that it happened back in the first century. The more popular view today is that it's going to happen in the future. There's another view, which was, it used to be called the Protestant view, because it was the view that was held by all the reformers. And even in the pre-Reformation times, the view was held by John Wycliffe and John Huss and William Tyndale and these guys before the Reformation. And then it was also held by Luther and Calvin and Zwingli and the rest of the reformers, really. Essentially, the view that was held by the reformers is that the man of lawlessness is not an individual man, but was a system. Just like the body of Christ is not an individual man, but it's a corporate entity made up of people attached to Christ. So the reformers thought that the man of sin was a system, and they identified it with the papacy, the Roman Catholic Pope system. And this did arise after Paul's time and still exists today. And according to the reformers, it is that system that will be destroyed by the brightness of Christ appearing at his second coming. So, according to the reformers, all of them, they believe that the Roman Catholic hierarchy, the popes and so forth, that was the man of sin. And that they sat in the temple of God, which is, of course, a term Paul used elsewhere for the church. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, in 1 Corinthians 6, in 2 Corinthians 6, Paul refers to the church as the temple of God. And when Paul said that the man of sin would sit in the temple of God, it was the view of the reformers that he meant that the man of sin would sit in the church and declare himself to be God. Now, those who held that view had a lot of interesting quotes taken from things the popes really had said, where the popes declared themselves to be in the position of God, and they certainly were positioned in the church. And so that was their view. Now, as far as what the restrainer was, they believed that the restrainer was the Roman Empire. They believed that the papacy could not rise to power in Europe as long as there were Roman emperors that had risen to power and were ruling. So they saw the fall of the Roman Empire and the removal of the Roman emperors as that removing of that restrainer that allowed the rise of the papacy to come up. So those are three different views that have been held. I have felt that the third view that was held by the Reformers seems to have the most biblically in its favor, in my opinion. And I, having taken as much time as I did to give the views, I don't have the time to go and critique them all individually. You did ask my opinion. My opinion is that the third view, the Reformed view, what for hundreds of years was called the Protestant view, has a lot in its favor, and I think it's probably more convincing to me than the other two alternatives. Okay, let's talk to Craig from Round Rock, Texas next. Hi, Craig. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hey, Steve.
Hi.
Hey, I just called to hear you sing. Come on.
Not today. Not today.
I know how you feel, man. It's rough. I wanted to see, you know, I have a kind of a lot of, I guess, different families in our home church or I guess, Christian acquaintances and friends that I've noticed there's been a lot of people having their young children baptized. At what I consider to be, you know, too young in age to really understand the full grasp of the gospel and have a weight or sense of their own, you know, disparity and all. You know, and one day it was a friend of ours had their 5-year-old daughter, I mean, barely five. And everybody was just, you know, praising the Lord and was really excited about it, that she had been wanting to do this, and she went and did it. And she came out of the water and she said, "I'm a new person." You know, and I'm thinking, well, I mean, how much of that is just parroting what her parents, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about all that?
Well, I would leave that to the discretion of the parents, because the Bible does not say how old a person has to be before they can come to faith. Obviously, Jesus said that little children can come to him and that they should not be forbidden from doing so. But it's always hard to know, like you say, if a child in a Christian home is merely parroting the views of their parents or if they have a faith of their own. And I would say when it comes to baptism, I would perhaps just leave that to the discretion of the parents. I think that a parent who knows their child well, if they are objective, would be able to say, well, I think maybe you need to wait until you're a little older to be baptized, because I'm not sure you fully understand what you need to understand. On the other hand, of course, there are those who go the opposite direction. They even believe that you should baptize your infants.
Right.
And they believe that by baptizing your infants, you're doing for them the same thing the Jews did when they circumcised their infants. And that is, you're bringing them into the believing community. And, of course, they'll have to make their own decisions about walking with God at a later date. But they're being baptized, as it were, by virtue of being in a covenant family. Their parents being covenant members of the body of Christ and being able to include their children. Now, I don't believe in infant baptism myself.
And I don't either, and this doesn't seem much different to me.
Yeah, it's perhaps a little different, because I have known people who have been Christians from their childhood. Well, I myself, as far as I know, became a real Christian when I was young. The first time I went forward at an altar call was when I was 4 years old. I don't know if I, you know, really was converted at that time or not, but I always was a believer after that. And for all I know, maybe that was when I became a convert. The church I was in, which was a Baptist church, they had a policy they wouldn't baptize children under 12 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to wait till then to be baptized. And I will say this, I baptized my children at ages under 12 because of my conviction that they knew what they were doing.
Sure.
But But, I mean, in retrospect, I'm not sure if they knew what they were doing or not, you know. But the idea of waiting till a child is 12 probably has its roots in the Jewish
bar mitzvah.
Practice of bar mitzvah, because the Jews believe that a child under 12 is pretty much under the spiritual responsibility of their parents. But when a child reaches 12 or 13, that child then reaches a mature age where that child then becomes responsible for his own obedience to the law of God and so forth. And I don't know, that tradition goes back pretty far. The Old Testament doesn't teach that tradition, but it may be a tradition like that that caused Jesus to be taken to the temple when he was 12 years old. but we don't know. Anyway, I would say I'd leave it to the parents' discretion. I don't believe in infant baptism, and I think a parent has every right to be skeptical about the depth of a child's conversion or professed conversion.
Yeah, but it seems like there's like a lack of discernment, just from my perspective, with what I see going on around me, in the sense that I don't know. I could see how it'd be more plausible with a child that's 8, 9, or 10, or like you said, almost 12. In that range, you know, every child's maturity is a different level, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, I mean, I have a daughter that's a year older than this girl. I'm like, there's no way, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes, she can say all the right things. And my, you know, and this parent did quote the verse about, you know, don't forbid the little children to come to me. And, of course, we wouldn't do that, but Jesus didn't baptize those children, nor did he tell his disciples to. You know, they came to him to talk with him and spend time with him. But, you know, there's no indication that that's what was in mind there.
True. And, you know, I think you have good reason to be skeptical about the wisdom of that move. The thing is, I do know people, including myself, who you know, made decisions as small children to follow Christ and have continued into old age without a break in that conviction. But, again, I'm not even sure I could say with certainty that I made a life-changing decision when I was 4 years old. Because I was raised in a Christian home, my life looked like a Christian life, and my beliefs were Christian beliefs. And would have been probably whether I'd gone forward at that altar call when I was four or not.
Right.
So, I don't know. Certainly, it wasn't until I was 16 that I came to really have a dynamic encounter with God that changed my life radically. So, I mean, it's possible that someone would say that was my true conversion. I don't know.
It just makes me nervous because, I did the same thing. I went forward at a young age, probably I think I was seven. And I can remember being drawn to Christ, but at the same time, I also remember the first thing that sparked my whole inquiring about the baptism was my friend next to me, who, you know, during communion at Baptist Church, you know, he never
take communion without being baptized, right?
Yeah, right, and he never partook, just like I never partook, and all of a sudden, one day, he's partaking, and I'm like, hey, what's up with that? You know, he's going to do this, and I found out that, oh, he made this decision to get baptized. Well, I want to do that, you know, and
yeah.
And
you probably didn't even know what communion was about. You probably just thought it'd be cool to have something to drink in the middle of the service.
I felt left out, yeah. I remember that feeling. And I mean, that's seven, you know. So, I kind of resent being allowed to go forward at that point because to me, I had this real big ambiguity. Like, when was I saved? Was I saved? You know, where I know others that did it at an older, more mature age, and there's like they can put a flag in the ground and say, look, this is when it happened, and this is, you know what I'm saying?
Okay, well, I understand what you're saying, and you make a good point.
Yeah, all right, well, something to share.
Okay, Greg. Hey, thanks, brother.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, we're going to talk next to Ken from Mount Vernon. It says California, but it's Washington. Hey, Ken, are you in Washington?
Yep.
Okay, yeah, my call screen thought you were in California. How are you doing?
Could be better. I'm kind of sad that the U.S. troops are fighting for the Vatican and in the Inquisition number 2.
I haven't heard about that.
Yeah, that's my belief is that the first Inquisition, the Catholic Church got people, you know, to fight for them, the Spanish Inquisition, and I believe this is the second Inquisition. It's not called that, of course, by our politicians. Actually, George Bush talked about crusade. They didn't want him talking, saying that word anymore. But anyway, but yeah, it's, yeah.
Do you have a question or comment about the Bible or about?
Well, anyway, no, it's not based on that. I'm just kind of sad that fellow Americans are going over there and dying for the cause of Illuminati in Iraq and Afghanistan. But anyway, my question was that I think I want to offer money or give donate money to your ministry because you're probably one of the only Christian radio ministries that believes the same way I do about the evil Catholic Church being the Antichrist throughout the ages of its existence of the Roman Catholic Church.
I believe the arguments raised by the reformers about that passage are fairly convincing. But they also identified the Roman Catholic Church with the beast of Revelation, and I don't do that. I believe that the man of lawlessness in 2 Thessalonians could well be identified with the papacy. But I actually take the beast of Revelation to be an entirely different entity.
Yeah, I take the view that ever since the popes, started the Roman Catholic Church and all that, with Constantine creating it and all that, I believe that there'll be one more pope. Only God knows. I don't pray to God and say, please, God, show me your secretive will. That's God's business. He's sovereign. But I do believe God revealed to me that there's going to be up till the end pope. He's going to be the one that's going to be, still blaspheming God, saying, I am the victor of Christ, and basically saying, God, I'm God on earth, and until the day God, Jesus Christ comes back and destroys.
Yeah, I wouldn't be able to speculate about that. But before you decide to send money to this ministry, you might want to listen to my lectures on eschatology and see if we agree enough for you to want to support it. You might not.
No, I do believe that God revealed to me that the Antichrist, Christ plural, more than one will be till the end. And I believe that most of our politicians take orders from the Vatican, the people of the high up, because the Catholic Church is a really good documentary put up by Walter Veit. It's called The Secret Behind Secret Societies, and there's a YouTube. You can watch it on YouTube.com. But it's absolutely amazing. It talks about how most politicians in America and Washington D.C. I call it the District of Criminals, D.C. standing for District of Criminals. I believe that they take orders because the reason I believe that is because so many of our politicians in Washington D.C. are involved in Freemasonry or linked to Illuminati. And what I found out through a study of history is that the Catholic Church says we are not part of the Illuminati, but they actually created the Illuminati and created Freemasonry.
Hey, Ken, let me stop you a minute here. Once we get on to conspiracy things, we can take up the rest of the program.
It's conspiracy. The Bible talks about
it. Right. Let me just say this, okay? I can't confirm or deny what you're saying, all right? But I'd like, my lines are full, and there's people who want to ask questions about the Bible and stuff. Do you have any questions about the Bible?
Oh, okay, yeah. Other than making that declarative statement, I was wondering, what is your view on where pastors of many, many denominational churches say that we should give money to the Babylonian Jewish religion? There's Babylonian Jewish Talmud, and a lot of Jews that hate Jesus Christ. I read some parts of the Talmud, and they hate Jesus Christ. Now, I don't.
Yeah, I know. Okay. Well, let me answer your question. First of all, I would state the question differently. I don't know of any pastors that say we should give money to the Babylonian Jewish religion, but I know what you're saying. You're saying that Judaism today is not the religion of the Old Testament, it's religion of the Talmud, and I agree with you about that. And the Talmud arose, as far as we can tell, during or after the Babylonian exile of the Jews, and it did seem to replace the Old Testament for many. I mean, certainly Jesus indicated that the Pharisees, who were the defenders of the Talmudic traditions, although the Talmud was not yet written, its tractates were orally passed down at that time, and the Pharisees were the ones who defended that. Jesus said that they actually rejected the Word of God in order to keep those traditions. So I agree with you that modern Judaism is, the religion of the Talmud. It is definitely Antichrist. There's no question about it. I'm not saying it's the Antichrist. I'm just saying that Talmudism is Antichrist. They reject Christ. They insult Christ in the Talmud. They call him all kinds of blasphemous names. And so I agree with you. And when Christian ministries and churches try to take up a collection to send to Israel to help, for example, fund the rebuilding of the temple, I think that's probably what you're referring to, I would say that's really misguided. I don't think that any rebuilding of the temple in Jerusalem would serve any Christian purpose. The temple itself was destroyed by God's judgment because of the rejection of Christ by the Jews, and their nation still rejects Christ formally, and therefore the rebuilding of the temple would just be in defiance of what God did. God brought judgment on the temple system because, well, for one thing, he finished with it when Jesus came, and then, of course, because those in the temple are the ones, the chief priests and so forth, the ones that crucified him. I believe that any effort to rebuild the temple today would be in defiance of Christ. And therefore, I can't imagine why any church would want to send money to help the temple be built. It's like, to me, it would be the moral equivalent of the churches sending money to a Muslim country to have a Muslim mosque be built. Because a Muslim mosque is a pagan shrine. A Jewish temple in Jerusalem would be a pagan shrine also. Pagan in the sense it's anti-Christian. So I don't see why any of the money that God provides to the members of his body should go to support an anti-Christian religion, when in fact there are needs of Christians, including Palestinian Christians, that probably should be helped out. And Jewish Christians, and Christians of all races. So I'm not one of those that agrees with the sending of support to Israel. Ken, I'm going to take some more calls, though. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
All right. Bless you.
Bye.
Okay, let's talk to Frank from Santa Cruz next. Hi, Frank. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Hey, Frank, caught you away from your phone?
Oh, sorry. Listening to you on the radio.
Yeah.
And I'm on my walk, so I'm a little huffing right at the moment. But
okay.
Those two things now. Way to go, refusing money from your listeners. but no, I appreciate your honesty with people.
I don't want people to send me money if they're later going to be sorry about something I said.
Yeah. Okay, well, of course, we're all going to be sorry that you said something. You know,
yeah, that's true.
You're going to gore one of our oxes somehow, but anyway, I really called to give Craig in Round Rock, Texas, another couple of data points. I, too, walked down the aisle in a Baptist church at 7 years old, and much later, like in college, kind of walked away from the Lord, although only partly as a result of seeking a really close relationship with God and not seeming to find it. So I walked away for something in the order of a decade and finally got back to him after my life kept falling apart. So in hindsight, I realized I was actually basing the whole thing on a lie in the first place, in that I had been, even as early as 7 years old, I knew what I wanted to do with my life, and I knew it wasn't, quote-unquote, throw it away as a missionary in Africa, based on all the missionary stories I'd heard.
Yeah.
So I kind of held back even at 7 years old. I was willing to give my Sunday mornings, Sunday nights, and Wednesday nights to the Lord and generally live by biblical principles. But I really wanted to hold on to my own life, and I knew perfectly well that discipleship meant more than that. But I was kind of willing to lie to myself as well as God. And I could have done that at 20, I think, also. So
yeah, I was going to say that. Yeah.
I didn't become an unqualified disciple. Nonetheless, I probably did about as much as I would have done at any other age, given that I valued my, you know, control of my career and so forth. And the second data point is my daughter, who falls right into the area that Craig was concerned about. And I, too, wouldn't ordinarily think that a three-and-a-half-year-old could truly give their life to Christ. And we were very dubious when our daughter announced that she wanted to get baptized. And our pastor was rather reluctant, also feeling like that was too young. But he interviewed her and decided finally to baptize her. We did, and approximately a week after she was baptized, she sinned in some way, and she was absolutely heartbroken. She was crying because she somehow had gotten the impression, even though the church wasn't teaching it and we didn't teach it, but she got the misimpression that she would never sin again. And so, of course, we had to explain to her that, no, we all still have this propensity to sin, and we just have to be overcome it with the Holy Spirit's power that we're given. So at any rate, that convinced us that she really did have a heart for God. She had given her heart for God, or to God, and so I guess I wouldn't question her salvation. She's now approaching 30 years old, and she's a good, solid Christian. I don't agree with her on all the theology, but it, you know, I may be wrong, or she may be wrong. But it's obvious to me that she's filled with the Spirit, and where the Spirit is, there's freedom.
That's great. So you've got two data. One of them, you know, questioning the wisdom of early baptism, and another one, supporting the fact that it could be genuine.
Yeah, right. So it's kind of ambiguous.
Yeah, that's why I would leave it to discretion.
I just thought I would maybe help Craig with a couple more data points that he could consider in his mullings over.
That's great, Frank. I appreciate that.
All right. Nice talking to you.
All right. God bless you. Bye now.
Bye.
All right, we're going to talk next to Michael from Everett, Washington. And we have a line open for you also. Let me give you the number. It's 1-800-438-5090. Now, you're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. My voice doesn't always sound like this. I'm recovering from laryngitis. I'm actually much better off than I was yesterday, and almost, well, infinitely better off than I was on Saturday. But it's getting better. But if you can endure it during the recovery period, we can have conversations. You can call me here at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Michael, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hello, Steve. I'm sorry to hear that you're having trouble with your voice. I was listening earlier to your conversation about, the name William Tyndale came up.
Yeah.
And I really wanted to find out your opinion of reliability of the work he did. What is your opinion on that?
Well, the translation work he did, frankly, I don't think we're using it now. So I don't really know very much about the reliability of it. I don't even think I've ever held a Tyndale Bible in my hands. And wasn't he killed before he finished the whole project? I believe he had done the New Testament, I believe.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just been looking into it recently myself here last year, latter part of last year. And I was quite surprised to find some of the writings of what his translation was really revealing. For example, the word church does not exist. And this was, you know, written 75 years before the King James was.
That's interesting. Did he use the word assembly, or what did he use?
No, he used congregation.
Congregation, okay.
Yeah, so...
How about then, the word baptism?
Pardon me?
How about the word baptism? Was that in there?
You know, I didn't even look that one up at all. I do know that the word Christian wasn't... it was kind of alluding to Christ men rather than Christian. I'm concerned that, you know, somewhere along the line after he was put to death by, I think it was King James himself and his something to do with the Pope, did put him to death for taking the scriptures and passing them out. Okay, so some of them, they tried to retrieve it, and some of it didn't get retrieved. And in fact, you can go online under Tyndale, William Tyndale translation, or just William Tyndale online, and you'll be able to read. I think he has some of the Old Testament there now too. That's come forth.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I don't know what the distinctives are of Tyndale's translation, as I said, because I've never read it, and I really doubt that it'll ever become a major translation, since there's so much work been done.
Oh, definitely. Since then. Yeah.
Okay. Well,
but it's an interesting read, and you know, he's definitely one that was speaking the truth from what I could read about, and there was a lot of suppression going on for whatever reason, but. My main concern was is that the title of church and Christian were absent. In fact, Congregation, he was translating the Latin into English, and Congregation was actually pronounced congregation.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. He wasn't using the Greek text, but the Latin text, and that's what set him apart from later translators. And that would make me think that his translation would probably have things about it that are not quite as accurate because it's one step removed from the Greek text further than most translations are today. But, yeah, I would be favorable towards using the word congregation instead of church. That's a good translation of ecclesia. All right. Well, I appreciate your call.
Thank you very much.
All right, Michael. Bye now.
Later. Bye-bye.
All right. Our next caller is Elizabeth from Kingston, Washington. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, thanks.
I thought in one of the last questions where you were talking about the rebuilding of the Jewish temple, maybe it was just the way I heard it, but are you alluding that God is somehow done with the Jewish people?
Yeah. Well, not done with the Jewish people. He's not done with any people. The offer of salvation is offered to all people, including the Jewish people.
Okay, because I know there is some, I believe, wrong theology going around that, you know, God is done with the Jews. They had their chance. They crucified Christ. And, you know.
Well, I've never heard that theology. I have heard people say that, you know, the Jewish nation as a nation does not have any, future significance in prophecy. But that's different than saying that God is done with Jewish people. Because God deals with people as individuals, and you know, a Jewish person, as much as any other person, can come to Christ and be saved.
So, in the end times, in the tribulation, they have a number of people that are going to be preaching the gospel. Aren't those Jewish people?
Well, you're thinking of the 144,000. My understanding of Revelation is not futuristic. I have a different view of Revelation, so almost all my presuppositions would be different from yours about that. I believe the Revelation is talking about a great tribulation that was predicted, as John said in the book, to happen shortly after his own time. And so I believe that when John said this would shortly come to pass and the time was near and so forth, that he was telling us that they were living near the time of fulfillment, and I believe they were. So I'm not looking for a future fulfillment of the book of Revelation.
Okay. Okay, that answers my question then. Thank you so much.
Yep. All right, Elizabeth. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, so John from Las Vegas, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Well, good afternoon. It's actually, it's Henderson, but it's close.
Right.
Yes, I was just wondering, and honestly, this is just a question, because in light of what's going on, really, in the last 2 days, I would imagine you support Israel as far as remaining a state and not being overrun by other nations. I certainly
do support Israel's right to exist as a nation.
Okay.
I don't know that I would call it a divine right any more than I think that America has a divine right to exist as a nation. I believe that nations rise and fall in the course of history through different means, often through warfare, sometimes through political negotiations. In the case of Israel, it was through a charter from the United Nations. But I believe that they have legitimacy as a nation.
Okay,
sure.
Well, you know, because I don't think it gets out often enough, you know, how the Islamic folks over the years, centuries, so many people don't even realize that Islam is not, they think of it as an old religion. Most people think it's older than Christianity, for example. And they took over so many Christian countries, and now they obviously want to take over Israel. But so many people don't know that, you know, Lebanon, for example, at one time was a Christian country, and so forth. I think you know where I'm trying to get to here. I just don't think it'd be a good thing for what's happening today to think of Islam taking over that whole area, including all these Christian areas that are there in Israel and so forth.
I didn't know there were Christian areas in Israel.
Well, I mean, that's where Christianity began, was in Israel.
Right, but I don't know of any Christian areas that are there now.
Well, I mean, there's churches there that were there.
Oh, sure, but there's churches in Palestine, too. In fact, there's more Christians per capita among the Palestinians than there are among the Israelis.
Right. But I used to be, my point is, at one time it was all either Israel, Jewish, or Christian, before Islam even came about, is my point.
That's true.
And so many people don't even realize that basic fact. And anyway, okay, I just humbly, I'll just say good day for now, and God bless you.
Okay, thank you. Bye now. All right, our next caller is Janet, who's also calling from the Las Vegas listeners. Hi, Janet.
Hi. I just wanted to ask you what you believe, because I know what the Bible says about it, but on the other hand, perhaps you could extend upon this idea. Where do we go? Where do Christians go? Where do wicked people go? A wicked person, I mean an individual. Where do they go when they're dead, when they die? When they take their last breath, and it's over in this world, where do they go?
Well, I believe that when Christians take their last breath in this world, they go to be with the Lord. That is, their spirit does.
And that is where?
Well, he's in heaven, you know. But what's more important is that they're with
the
Lord.
God is in the third heaven. I'm not arguing with you. Go ahead. Tell me your belief.
I don't understand what you're asking.
Well, we're back to the same question. Where does a righteous person go when they die? Where does a wicked person go when he takes the last breath on earth?
Okay, didn't I answer one of those questions?
Well, not to my satisfaction. Could you go over it again, perhaps?
Okay.
Maybe I don't get it.
Well, let's take the first question. Where does a righteous person go when they die?
Okay.
They go to be with the Lord. You said, where is that? And I said, in heaven. Jesus is in heaven at the right hand of God. So if Christians go to be with the Lord, heaven is where they go.
Okay.
What do you believe?
I believe we all sleep. The wicked and the good, they sleep. It says in Ecclesiastes, I guess it is, or Proverbs, I think it's Ecclesiastes. It says the dead know not anything.
Yeah, it's Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Well, that's true. It does say the dead don't know not anything. I think it means they don't know anything that's going on the earth. There's certainly plenty of places that would say the opposite.
It says there is no knowledge or understanding in the grave.
Okay, yeah, in the grave there would be none. But the
body
is in the grave, you're right.
Yeah.
But the question is, where is the person's soul? And if they're...
Well,
if their soul,
it says, okay, it says, fear not him that can kill the body, but fear him that can destroy both body and soul in hell.
Right.
But hell is the grave.
Well,
so the spirit.
I agree that the body and soul can be destroyed in hell, but Jesus is not talking about just dying there, because he said, "Do not fear him who can only kill the body." Well, that's talking about dying, right?
Mm-hmm.
He says, "But do fear him that can kill the body and the soul." So the death of the soul or the destruction of the soul is treated as a separate issue than the death
it's
of the body.
It's used together, sir, body and soul. It's
okay.
Used together.
As you wish, as you wish.
Well, that's what it says. I mean, it doesn't say anything else.
Okay. Well, I'm very much aware of that verse. I don't think I see it.
Okay, now we're going to heaven. We did that. What about the wicked? Where do they go?
They go to the grave.
Well, you know the yourself, the most of the churches teach they go to burn and flame of fire.
Well, I'm aware of what most churches teach about that.
I disagree, don't you?
Well, I think they don't have a strong case.
Okay. No, they don't have a strong case. For one thing, it says that the lake of fire was prepared for the devil and his angels, and they go there at the judgment.
Right.
And
the
last
fire,
day, they go there to the judgment, at the judgment.
That's right. All whose names are not found written in the Lamb's Book of Life will be cast into the lake of fire at the judgment. Right.
Right. Well, I guess you've answered my question.
Okay. Well,
but you know what we've been taught. I mean, crying out loud, we've been taught, you better stay away from those burning brimstone fires to go to hell if you don't quit it. Okay?
Well, I don't think I was really taught that. I mean, my parents certainly did believe
in
heaven and hell, but I don't remember them ever using that as the motivation for me to do the right thing. But, yeah, I mean, I think it's probably not the best motivation. Because a lot of people...
Well, they scare us into it, a lot of, you know.
Yeah,
anyway.
Well, most people who are scared... Okay, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Bye, Janet. Yeah, I should clarify what my point is on this. Janet apparently holds the view of soul sleep, which is the view of the Seventh-day Adventists and also the Jehovah's Witnesses. It's also the view of many Christians. By the way, I think Seventh-day Adventists are Christians. But... that view that she holds is that when you die, whether you're saved or lost, you go into a state of unconsciousness. And then you'll be raised on the last day to the judgment and then sent to wherever it is you go. The more widely held evangelical view is that when we die, we don't go immediately to the judgment, but we go somewhere else to wait. And most evangelicals believe that our spirit goes to be with God if we're saved. And that if we're not saved, our spirit goes into a place of flames to await the judgment. That latter point is supported by a single passage, and that is the story of Lazarus and the rich man in Luke 16. And that's the only place that ever mentions such a thing. If that is a literal story, then that is a good view to believe. If it's only a parable, as some people have thought, it's hard to say whether that's a description of where they go immediately after death or not. But this is a larger issue than we can resolve in the time we have. As a matter of fact, I only have 45 seconds. So I just need to tell you, you've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. Yeah, we are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to write to us, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California, 95063. You can also donate if you want to using PayPal from our website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. I hope you tune in again tomorrow. I hope my voice will be stronger then. And we'll continue our discussion. God bless you.